directional, transforming, musical, linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. I'm Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. I've been reading this book the last couple days. It's edited by Charlie Grove and Roger Walsh, and it's called Higher Wisdom. Eminent Elders Explore the Continuing Impact of Psychedelics. And it's a series of interviews with people like Ram Dass, Gary Fisher, Michael Harner, Albert Hoffman, Laura Huxley. It's really, really an interesting book. And when I got to the interview they did with Gary Fisher, I remembered a tape recording I made of a conversation Gary and I had last summer. And actually, it was one that we did as a test to see if we could pull some stories together for a Psychedelic Salon recording. Unfortunately, you know, I made the recording on my old 10-year-old cassette tape recorder, and then moved it into MP3 over this little $12 Radio Shack mic I'm using here. And so obviously the quality leaves a lot to be desired, and I'm working on that, and your suggestions, of course, are appreciated. They are coming in, and I thank you. Anyway, after reading Charlie Grove's interview with Gary, I took another listen to it. You know, sometimes when people are friends of yours and you get to know them on a different level than just reading their books, you tend to forget some of the great work that they really did. And so I took another listen to this tape because the stories and the information that Gary puts out is I think, pretty important. As I said, the sound quality is not too great. It was a hot day, and we had to have the sliding glass doors and windows open, but the content, I think, is really excellent. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Gary's story, I've put up a web page about him with some links to his papers, to some of his papers that are online, and just click on Gary's name on our podcast page at matrixmasters.com. And as you'll see, few people have played such a wide-ranging role in the research of psychedelic substances as Gary has. His research not only included testing schizophrenic and autistic children with LSD and other psychedelic medicines. Gary also was with Tim Leary in Mexico, the Caribbean, and finally at Millbrook, and hopefully I'll get him to share some of these experiences with this crowd, and also with the Huxleys and some of the other bright lights of early psychedelic research. I think you actually might be pretty surprised by some of his observations about that period in our tribe's history. Now, let's get to the tape at hand, and as I said, the sound quality isn't great, but I can promise that Gary's stories will soon have you laughing and crying and often at the same time. I'm going to pick up here in the conversation just after I'd mentioned to Gary that Harvard has started a new study involving cluster headaches and the possible use of LSD to ease some of that pain. So here we are with a conversation with Gary Fisher.
It's interesting about the cluster headaches that you had said about LSD for that phenomenon. And this must have been in the 60s that when Sandoz basically stopped making LSD for distribution, that they came up with a drug called Sansert, S-A-N-S-E-R-T, which was in the LSD family, and it was for headaches. It was
really?
For migraines.
Really? So they were already starting that work back in the 60s. Wow. Isn't it amazing how much
how things recycle.
Yeah, and how much time has been lost. Mm-hmm. That, how did you get approval to do your set? What was the process back then?
Oh, that's so funny, approval. My approval when I came back from Canada after having my first LSD experience, and I thought, well, if it worked for me, it'll work for anybody. And so I had been working with the schizophrenic children at this hospital.
You'd already been involved in that work.
Yeah, working with them, but you know, getting nowhere because they're extremely, very difficult to work with.
What age group did you work with?
I think the youngest one we had maybe was 4 years old.
Wow.
Up to about 11, I would say.
Really young.
Yeah. And the psychiatrist was who was on ran the ward. He and I got along real well, and he thought I was like Looney Tunes and all, so I got interested in.
What hospital was this in?
I'm going to put that down.
Oh, okay, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But it was a state hospital in California,
okay,
run by the Department of Mental Health. And so I told Dan, you know, what my experiences was, and well, you know, nobody had heard it.
And what year was this?
60.
Wow.
1960. Because I had my first experience, I guess, in 59.
Who administered it the first time?
My brother-in-law, Nick Shawalis, who was taught by Hubbard, Al Hubbard, who was, you know,
yeah. He was the real Johnny Appleseed. Yeah,
yeah. He was a fountainhead.
Yeah.
And, of course, he taught the people in Menlo Park, too.
Right. He was the...
He was a guru there.
That got Myron really off and going. I think he took Myron on his first experience. Yeah.
Right. And he was a character.
Did you actually meet Hubbard?
No, never met
Just
Hubbard.
You were there for the fresh reputation of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was still around, of course, but I never physically met him. So I told the psychiatrist, his name was Dan, I said, I'd really like to try these with the kids because we have nothing to lose. And he said, fine.
Were these kids so sick they were actually hospitalized?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They were in what was called in those days a back ward. High security. A lot of the kids were in straitjackets because they were so violent. And, you know, very self-destructive, destructive to others. It was like the picture of back wards asylums. You know, people were violent.
Like what the movie showed?
Yeah, what the movie showed.
Wow.
These were all kids. And they would, you know, bite each other and hit each other. And I mean, they were uncontrollable. And they were all on different kinds of drugs to calm them down. But in those days, you know, there weren't even tranquilizers. You know, that was pre-tranquilizer days. We didn't even have Thorazine back then. And so he said, well, yeah, let's try it. And so he said, well, we'll start with Nancy because she's dying anyway. And so...
How old was she?
Nancy was probably 11.
Wow.
And she was in what's called a camisole, which is a wraparound, where they're tied, you know, legs and feet.
Just a fancy straitjacket name.
Yeah, a fancy straitjacket name. And tied to a bed, tied down to a bed. Because if you let her loose, she would try to gouge her eyes out or bite her fingers off.
You said she was dying, so did she have
She had a thing called what's known as marasmus. And it's where children just simply die because they're committed to dying.
Really?
And even if they feed them intravenously nutrients, the body doesn't absorb it. And it comes from children who are terribly isolated and, you know, non-communicative, totally in a world of their own. And they die from...
They just don't want to be here.
Yeah, they don't want to be here. And it's called marasmus. And so he said, well, she's dying anyway. And so let's try it with her. And I thought, oh, good Gora. You know, what we're going to do with her might kill her. So that'll be the end of this project. You know, if we kill the first person we could try it on. And... But I always remember Dan's grin and so forth. And he said, well, she said, that's the safest one to try it on because she's going to be dead anyway. So nothing to lose.
And so you didn't have to go through an IRB and things like that.
No, I tell you, you know, this will be rambling, but it'll probably be okay.
Yeah.
One of the funny things is that people hadn't heard of LSD. And so I was telling somebody one day that we were trying LSD with these psychotic children, and he said, why would you try to convert children to Mormonism to cure their insanity? He says, that sounds really bizarre, because Mormons are known as Latter-day Saints, as LDS. So he thought that we were converting them to Mormonism. That's how popular LSD was.
Wow.
Nobody heard of it. Sandoz was sending it out in the mail, to physicians. To try it on different disorders to see if it would work.
And all a physician had to do is write and ask for it?
Oh, no, they were sending them up free in the mail.
Wow.
Yeah, sending them up in the mail. One guy wrote back and said it doesn't work as a sedative. He said he tried it with patients at bedtime, and he said they were up all night with the most incredibly described dreams I've ever heard in my life, so they didn't get any sleep. And so it's not a sedative. This was the state of...
Well, you know, I shouldn't laugh. I mean, how do you learn, you know?
This is a state of, quote, approval. We've never heard of, you know, approving, getting drugs approved for anything in that era.
Wow. That's as recently as 1960.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Sandoz was just sending them out for people to try to see what might work for.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know. And so we tried it with her, and I even have pictures of her. I've got to find somebody to give things to before I pass on and my children won't know what to do with it, or they'll probably get all thrown away. But I actually have photographs of some of these kids.
You know, it'd be nice if you also, you know, as you're getting it in a pile to give to somebody, if you turn on a tape recorder to kind of describe them as you're doing that, so because we're not going to know who the kids are if we look at the pictures without a description.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
it'd
be a lot of work, but...
No, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And Nancy was skin and bones. I mean, really skin and bones. I mean, she looked like somebody from a prison camp who'd never been fed because, she was wasting away. Maybe these days it would be called a wasting syndrome because her body was just disintegrating. Her eyes were all sunken in her head, and she was black and blue from hitting herself, and not in communication with anybody, totally withdrawn. And so we started with her. And at that time, we were giving it intramuscularly because we couldn't give it to her orally. And so we gave, and you know, she had no muscle, so it was like awful. You know, it was really tragic. But anyway, she was the first one.
Well, you're giving Nancy her first. You injected it in what quantity, dose?
Well, I was going to say, I don't know how much we gave her. I suspect we probably maybe gave her 200 mics or maybe 400 mics. And she probably weighed, maybe 55 pounds or something. You know, she was
a
skeleton.
Big dose then.
She was a skeleton, Because that was Hubbard's, it was called the psychedelic model, as it came to be known. To give them a big enough dosage so that they can't fight it.
They couldn't resist.
That they can't resist it. It overpowers any ego trying to fight it off. So that was the model. This other model, of course, that they were using in England was called psycholytic, where they were giving smaller dosages and doing psychotherapy after the person had taken it. My friend Joyce Martin and all the English people were using that model. They hadn't heard about the psychedelic model. There wasn't any communication, really, between people.
Just regular mail at the time and journals, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, things really weren't published then because there was nothing to publish. And she was quiet and uncommunicative. She would mumble to herself, and and curse. Most of her mumbling was just cursing. And so finally, since we decided to take her out of the camel shawl, and then because there were about four of us there, and hold her down in case she started, you know, beating on herself. And then the first thing that happened was after about 30 minutes, she started, what would be the term, like a wounded animal in despair.
Do you think we could maybe shut this window while he's doing his yard work there?
It sounded like an animal in distress. That's the best way that I could describe that. It was this howling and just terrible distress. And then it got louder and louder and louder. And here is this little piece of protoplasm making all this noise. And it went on and on and on. It got louder and louder.
I imagine you were all getting kind of concerned then.
Well, it was a change, you know. Something different was happening. So that was encouraging.
Oh, okay.
And so it went on and on, and just howling. And so finally, after about 4 hours, I mean, I don't know how she had the energy to do that, but after about 4 hours, and we would try to talk to her, you know, during this, you know, ask her what was she howling about and what was wrong and so forth. Nothing. No response whatsoever. It's just as though we didn't exist. But she never responded to anybody anyway. She never talked to anybody anyway. But then we kept doing that, and so finally we just gave that up after about 3 hours and just sat and looked at each other. And so finally, in my desperation, I just yelled at her. I said, "Nancy, for God's sake, stop this racket. I can't stand it anymore. You're driving me crazy." You know, not that I expected an answer, you know. And she stopped, and she said, and this is her first communication that we'd ever heard from her, "Leave me alone. I have a long way to go." And then she went right back to screaming and howling. And we just went, "Holy shit. There's somebody in there. You know, there's a person, there's a live person in there."
Amazing.
And that was the first session we did. And, of course, we had many, many, many sessions with her. I don't know how many. I have records of it, but many, probably 25 or 30. And, boy, she was a handful.
Oh. Did she howl every time?
Well, no. She went through, you know, all kinds of stages, and the stages were long. I mean, you know, we were 6, 7, 8 hours with them, with each kid that took it, and we would be worn out because it was so intensive. She would go through tremendous amounts of living through. One of the things that she lived through, which was very clear to us, was being raped by her grandfather.
Really?
Yes, that was very, very clear. Pleading with him to stop. Mm. And that it hurt her. And she would have this sound of, "Ow, ow, ow. That hurts, that hurts." You know, just screaming. Ugh, it was blood curdling.
I guess.
And this was her grandfather raping her.
Mm.
And so that went on for hours during different sessions. So it was, you know.
Poor little girl had a lot to work through, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. She was, even though she was 11 or 12, she looked like an old woman of maybe 80.
Wow.
Because she was all sunken. Her eyes were sunken. Her cheeks were sunken. She was all sallow, you know, yellowish color skin. She was an old, old soul of sorts. But you know, to make a very, very long story short, she was a tough one to deal with because she was so smart and turned out to be very, you know, as she got better, very manipulative and wanting her own way about everything.
So she started communicating a little
bit. Oh, yes. She started communicating.
After the sessions, too, or only during them?
After.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So this opens her up, then?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And she was so funny. One time we were bringing her back from the visitor's room, which is where we did the session, because these kids never had any visitors, because they were basically all abandoned. And their family never came to visit them or anything, these kids. And so we used, quote, the visitor's room. And so one day somebody was there, and they were looking for somebody. And so Nancy loved when people came to the ward because she always went to them and wanted to talk to them and find out, you know, all about them and so forth and so forth.
So she became kind of outgoing. So
she
really outgoing. Did alter
oh,
her.
Oh, yeah, she became very outgoing. And they were asking for someone. And so she said, oh, yeah, I know where they are. She knew everything that went on in the ward. And she said, I'll take you down there. That's the visitor's room. You know, that's the room where you get to see God. And the visitor, of course, thought, well, this is just their psychotic band playing, you know, but this is where you get to see God. So that's how we used to call it that way. And then what she would try to do, if it was another kid's turn, she would try to say, well, I'll give you candy if you'll let me take your turn today.
Yeah,
I'll find some food for you that you like, and I'll steal something for you and give it to you. But I want your turn today. You don't need a turn. You're fine. You know, and she'd tell them, you know, all kinds of things.
So she recognized that the LSD was the medicine that was
helping. Oh,
her.
Yes. Oh, yes.
That's
But she was a handful. Oh, my God. One day we were coming back from the session. We were coming by the dining room. It was just pandemonium. These kids, you know, trying to feed them because they'd throw food all over each other, you know. It was just, oh, what a mess it was, constantly. And so it was glassed in, the room, and with wires in the glass so they wouldn't shatter. And so she was standing there looking at them. Here is this little girl who's like skin and bones, black eyes, bruises all over her body. And one of the attendants, whose name was Van, who was a sweetheart, and she said, Van, look at them. Just look at them. Isn't that wonderful? They're eating. She said, and she made this gesture like the queen, let them eat all they want. like the prima donna, you know, who was in charge of the world. Let them eat all they want, you know. And we just was hysterical laughing at her. But she didn't like to be laughed at, so I had to be sort of careful. But she was a tough one.
Now, you said in the beginning that she was actually wasting away. Did she ever start eating again?
Oh, yes.
She did?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, she started eating right away.
The 20 or so sessions, over what period of time did you treat her?
I would think about maybe 18 months. Mm.
And then what happened to her in the future?
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about her since I'm remembering it. She was very much into controlling things. She was a real control freak. And if she didn't get her way, then what she would do is that she would take her fist and she would hit herself in the eyes to hurt herself. And so we didn't know exactly, you know, how to deal with... We didn't know how to deal with any of this stuff, you know. Everybody, it was all experimental. We were learning day by day. But we wanted to get to the point, of course, where she would abandon her self-destructiveness, but that was so tied to her wanting things her way, in her control, that if she didn't get her way, then that's what she would do. So the last vestige of this control thing, we would take her out of the camisole, we would then tie her, we would put gloves on her hands, heavy gloves, so if she, you know, started to sock herself, it wouldn't hurt her so much, and then she would try to bite the gloves off and so forth. It was a constant struggle working with this kid, because she was so, she was so powerful.
It sounds like she was pretty smart, too.
Oh, she was incredibly smart. And one time I had heard her say, she was talking to one of the other kids, and she said, well, I can't handle the day staff anymore. They're on to me. But I've got the night staff pretty still. I've got them still under my thumb. They're doing what I want them to do because they haven't caught on, you know, how to deal, you know, with me because I'm too smart for them. I overheard this, and I said, oh, that's an interesting thing, Nancy. I'll have to talk to the night staff. She turned around and said, Gowie, God damn you fucking asshole. You know? She said, you've just blown it, haven't you? Now I won't have control over anybody. And I said, isn't that going to be a shame? You know, so we had that kind of, you know, exchange. Gowie, God damn you, asshole. You know?
Coming from a little girl would be strange.
Yeah. But, oh, she was a tough one. So the final thing I always remember that what we did, she got into this magic that if she had a piece of Kleenex and on her hands, that the Kleenex would stop her from hitting herself because she denied that she had control over hitting herself. That was part of that phase that she went through. She couldn't control it. And we kept telling her, yes, you can control it. And so we'd get into big fights about that. So then she would take the gloves off, take everything off, and then she would have pieces of Kleenex on her hand, and that would control her. And so, fine, as long as you know that's what you're going to do. And then, if something happened that she wasn't getting her way, we couldn't let her run the whole world.
Right.
It was quite impossible. I think there were 45 kids on the ward. And so she would take a piece of Kleenex off and then smash herself again. And so then, of course, we would, tie her hands up again. And but that was the last thing that she actually gave up. During a session one time, I said, I want you to know how powerful you are, to use your power in a good way, not in a bad way. That's what we kept working on, use your power in a good way. And so I'm going to take these Kleenex off your hands, and you watch. And you have total control over not to hit yourself. Because you're not bad, you don't need to be punished. You know, we did the whole psychoanalytic thing, and I said, now you watch. And so she took them off and looked, and she said, well, God damn, you're right. You know, and that was the end of all of her self-destructiveness.
Really? That? Like a switch?
Well, it was a long
time
long,
to throw it.
Long time coming.
But it finally just ended like that.
Yeah. But she was amazing. And then, of course, what she wanted to do is that she wanted to come in and sit in on sessions with other kids, you know, to teach them how this stuff worked. And she was. I mean, she was very helpful with other kids. She would look after them, talk to them. She was one of the group of the people that the girls that we were working with, we had boys too. I think we had more girls than boys, and she became very much part of the staff, and she started identifying with the staff and treating the other patients like she was part of the staff. And of course, we really encouraged that, and, you know, gave her a great deal of praise for how helpful she was, and she loved that.
Well, you know, what's fascinating to me about that story is that in my personal experience, both myself and other people have seen that when they first find these medicines, one of the first things they want to do is to help other people with them. And it's interesting to see how intrinsic that is down to such a young person.
Yeah.
And such a disturbed person still having that human impulse to help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, she was very much into it.
Did you ever get to oral doses, or did she always have to have an injection?
It didn't come in oral doses.
Oh, really?
It just came in injectable doses.
Huh. I didn't realize that.
Psilocybin came in pill form. And, of course, we experimented with all kinds of combinations. You know, we would sometimes give them 30 milligrams of psilocybin and then LSD later. I mean, we experimented with all kinds of dosages.
Now, this is something that I'm just now hearing about, and Myron has been talking about it. Menlo Park, they combined other several medicines. And you know, there's a lot of polydrug use going on out among young people experimenting right now. And to me, it's kind of fascinating that within a, you know, essentially a research setting, you are starting to even look at the poly, the combinations of these drugs. And so apparently that's been since the beginning of time that's been happening. Is that true?
I published a paper on that in a magazine called The Psychedelic Review on the use of different dosages and combination of psychedelics. You know, like 1960 or 61 or whatever it was. So it was published 45 years ago.
That's got to be one of the first papers on
oh, yeah.
on that.
Oh, yeah.
It seems to have come kind of full circle. I know all this was, and I don't want to use the word elitist, but he was he thought these medicines should be used in a more educated way, that where people would know what they're doing, have, you know, not just in the hands of the party crowd that Tim Leary was approximating. And a recent editorial in a magazine, a guy named James Kent wrote a really great editorial in his magazine just before it went under, about maybe we ought to revisit some of this thought about, you know, these medicines aren't for everybody. They shouldn't just be out on the street. They should, you know, they should be accessible, but after you know what you're doing and you have a guide and things like that. And it seems like Huxley and Leary had two different approaches to that problem. I think Leary sort of thought it would be for the masses, and Aldous thought it should be more for people who are trained first. I don't know. Is that accurate of how they were approaching the whole issue? Psychedelic usage?
Well, you couldn't find two people who were more opposite than Leary and Aldous Huxley. I mean, they didn't even inhabit the same planet.
Hmm.
No. I would hope that people know about a book that Aldous wrote called Island, because that's a very, very good look at how he thought these medicines should be used right from childhood. And Island is all about, of course, the ideal society and the ideal way of raising children. Have you read Island?
Oh, Mary C. and I each have a copy. I've read it probably three times.
Okay.
And the last time I read it was just after I met Laura for the first time, when she said Aldous believed that was his most important book.
Yes.
And so I went back and reread it again. And I haven't read it since hearing. I've heard you say this once before about a sort of how to raise children. I haven't read it with that view in mind, and so I should probably reread it again with that. The thing about Island that I think disturbs everybody is the truth of it at the end, when the rumbles of war are coming to the island too, that you can't escape society as well. You know, and I think part of his message was, how do we integrate this consciousness into the warlike society that we're in?
Yes, I suppose it's both complicated and simple at the same time. I would have to reread the end of Island. One of the ways that I'm so turned on to is that children have intuitive knowledge. Of course, my point of view is that we've all lived thousands of lives, and in each lifetime we come in, we bring all of the residue of all these hundreds and thousands of lives that we've had. I remember in one of the sessions that I had, I got back to the point where what existed in terms of, quote, life on the universe was a single cell. And I experienced myself as a single cell. Now, the language, of course, is impossible to describe how I would have reflective consciousness, which I didn't have reflective consciousness, being a one-cell organism, but I had consciousness. And I know what it's like to have consciousness when you're a one-cell being.
You know, this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but was it more comfortable and enjoyable than being a multi-cell being? I mean, you had your act together all in one cell. You didn't have to worry about these parts.
It was ecstatic simplicity.
that's a nice picture, actually.
But also limited. Yes. It wasn't the same as, for instance, nirvana. Like under LSD or through meditation or what have you, when you reach a state of nirvana or bliss or satori, whatever you want to call it, different religions call it different things. That's a different kind of consciousness. That is the apex of the consciousness being, which encompasses the whole. See, the language just goes.
Yeah.
There's no language for any of this stuff.
That's
but anyway, the consciousness of nirvana is very, very, very different. It's also very simple, but it's also exceedingly complex in the sense of the completeness of it. But, you know, this language is all irrelevant. I think it's really irrelevant.
I think that's why they say it's ineffable, you know, that these experiences are And there's the difficulty of how do we bring this back
yeah.
to the world.
So what Aldous was saying, I get sidetracked, but I sometimes remember where I was going. And with children, they come in with a lot of intuitive knowledge. My middle child, her name is Bess, and I will. If we have time, I'll tell you the circumstances under which she was born, which were very, very unique. Anyway, she just knew a lot. We used to call her the Buddha baby. She was sort of round and incredible, wonderful temperament. Everybody wanted to be around her. You know, if the lady next door was having a bad day, she'd call over and ask if Bess could come over for an hour.
Wow.
You know, so she was the social worker in the neighborhood. but she was. She was just had amazing compassion and acceptance of people. And she would come up with things that were just amazing. Like one time, we were sitting in the car and she said, "I love you to infinity." And I said, I understand what infinity is, but if you're going to tell somebody what infinity was, how would you describe what infinity is? And so she thought. She said, "Well," she said, "if we got out of the car right now and we started walking right in a straight line in front of us, and we walked forever and forever, we would still never get there, and that's what infinity is."
How old was she?
3. So I said, and I get chills
yeah.
right now when I think about it. I said, "Well, Bess, how do you know that?" And so she thought, and she thought, and she said, "I just noted And that's, you know, that's a wonderful story because she just knew things. And she had no idea how she knew it. Because, and my understanding of that, being so, you know, horribly intellectual, is that there's an accumulation of wisdom that somehow you bring in, that children bring in. And what Aldous's point was, that you start giving them the psychedelics when they start moving away from that intuitive knowledge, so that you constantly nurture the intuitive wisdom that people come in with. After my first LSD session, I went back to my mentor's house, as I say, my brother-in-law, and they had young twins, and they were probably maybe 9 or 10 months old, or 11 months old, something like that. And there was a boy and a girl. And so I was immediately just fascinated with them, went down and sat. They were in sort of a, what do you call it? Not cribs, but the playpen.
Playpen.
And so I got on the outside and lay down and just was looking at them. Looking at the boy.
So you were probably still somewhat altered from your experience?
Completely.
Ah.
And continued to be for about 6 months. And so I was just looking and looking and looking at him and having, of course, this nonverbal communication. And then he gave a message to his sister, who was across on the other side of the playpen, come over here, there's somebody here. Come here, there's somebody here.
And she crawled over.
And then she crawled over. And so the three of us had a, you know, a thing together. But he immediately recognized that I was there.
Interesting.
And doing whatever they're doing. But, you know, the most important document that I've seen in years is Donald Topping's article in MAPS, where he describes his experience in getting rid of his cancer through the ayahuasca experience.
The man in Hawaii?
And that, to me, any people who are interested in research about how these medicines work, that's a gold mine. Because he got such incredible results. You know, he was entirely cancer-free in 3 ayahuasca sessions. And he lived another 10, 11 years after that, cancer-free. I had written to Donald. I knew Donald when I lived in Hawaii. I mean, it's a small world. When I worked for the University of Hawaii, he was a language, he was a, for Peace Corps, he was a linguistics specialist. And here, 40 years later, you know, we run into each other again. Because when I wrote him, he said, aren't you the guy that was giving LSD to children? You told me all these amazing things that happened. He said, and then that's when, you know, then after that he got cancer. And then that's how he got to ayahuasca.
Right.
So, you know, talk about stitching together over time.
Talk about lives that have been intertwined without even knowing it for years.
Yes. And, but my, and I said, Donald, you've got to write down how you think that happens. How you think that ayahuasca works. Because, you know, I was trained as a scientist. I have a PhD in research psychology and research methodology. So that's just part of my bones, you know, looking at the world that way, too. And so he did write it, and he wrote it up. That's exactly what I thought, too. But I didn't want to tell him what I thought. But what he said, how he thought it worked, was exactly what I thought it worked too. So it was very interesting. Now that's just a gold mine, this one guy writing this one article. But I don't know if anybody pays any attention to it.
That article is I've had dozens of people tell me about that article just out of the blue. That one has stuck in a lot of minds.
Good. Because, you know, he wrote the follow-up to it.
Right.
Sequence. But I know, I mean, I was in academia. I was never stuck in academia. I never was stuck in anything because I was always just visiting, you know, different parts of my life. Rather than having the same thing in a lifetime. I've had, you know, 10 or 12 lifetimes.
You didn't come here to stay. You just came here to visit.
Just
to kind of close the loop on Nancy, what became of Nancy, the young
woman? Well, one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life is to tell them that we couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, that I was basically out of a job.
Did they stop you before LSD got scheduled, or was it part of the whole scheduling thing?
It was part of the whole scheduling. Everything happened very, very quickly. And it happened quickly almost everywhere, in England and the Netherlands and Switzerland. You know, it all happened sort of in a rather short time period where everything got shut down. So it was heartbreaking meeting those kids. And I think one of the papers I wrote about one of the other girls, who was just an amazing, amazing story about this kind of girl, about telling her and her response to me telling her. So, yeah, it was very, very difficult meeting them. But she was attending. They had a school within the hospital, and she got to the point that she would go to the school in the hospital. And she was a worker on the ward, you know, with the other kids. She was part of the staff.
So, well, you know, is there anybody you know of right now doing work with children in LSD? I mean, is that just totally ended when you were...
Yes.
When you were stopped, that stopped the work. Did anybody else work with children that you know of?
Well, Loretta Bender, who was a neurologist at the University of Chicago, she was into doing a lot of experimentation. And she gave some autistic children LSD, but she didn't work with it therapeutically. She gave it as a drug, and they just prescribed it and didn't do anything with the kids. I mean, nothing, you know, because we use it as a tool for doing psychotherapy. But she didn't, and she didn't get any results.
Well, yeah, it's very difficult to expect these medicines to do it on their own.
So, but let's go back and wrap up one thing, and then we'll finish. But the thing about where would it be in an ideal culture? Definitely, you know, my experience tells me it shouldn't be on the streets. It shouldn't be passed out to uninformed people. That somehow people need to be trained in how to use it, and train other people on how to use it. So to have sort of like psychedelic therapists available in the culture, that would be quite an accomplishment. But they would have to be trained by people, some of us who are still alive, before we're all dead.
They better hurry up.
Yeah,
right?
Better hurry up. And then using Island, of course, as a model, too, to use it with children when children reach certain ages.
Yes, I remember Island. There were two or three, four or five plateaus when children and adults, early adults, said there were certain times in their life where it was like a therapeutic session, a guided session. You know, I recently heard a talk Terrence McKenna gave talking about psychedelics and culture, and that how they're really against one another, because cultures like to preserve the status quo, and psychedelic medicines break barriers, break boundaries, and so that it's very difficult to introduce or to instill a psychedelic sensibility into a culture without totally unraveling the culture, at least was his...
I think there are many aspects to that, and one of them is that it's been used in Indian cultures for many, many, many years, and it's a part of the Indian culture. But the Indian culture basically has never been a materialistic culture. It's been a spiritual culture. That the medicines determine what the culture was. which was a spiritual quest, and to be at one with nature. So there was no conflict, it was complete harmony. But introducing that to Manhattan real estate developers might be a stretch for some of those chaps.
It might be. Yeah, I think that's a point well taken about the both the green feeling, the closeness with nature that you feel, and the non-materiality really work against the culture that we're
Our culture is based on there's a scarcity, there's a limited supply of everything, and you have to work like hell to get your share. That whole thing is a delusional system. There is abundance on the planet. And but our system, our economic system, the Western economic system, won't work if people thought that there was abundance, because then they would stop running like rats, like crazy in a cage, trying to get their pellet
right
out of the slot. So it depends on the culture. And in Brazil, the use of ayahuasca is done within a religious, spiritual setting. And it's not at all at odds with the Indian culture there. Because they're trying to preserve nature.
Right.
So, there you have eminent elder Gary Fisher in his own words. Isn't it amazing how far ahead the medical community was in psychedelic research before the war on drugs brought all of that promising work to an end? Just thinking about Gary's story about that poor little girl Nancy, and then thinking about how many thousands of seriously ill other children there were like her that could have been saved from a hellish life if only they'd let this research go forward. Now, if you want to read more about Gary's work, by the way, you'll find links to many of his papers on our website. Just go to matrixmasters.com and click on podcasts, and there you'll find the link from this podcast to Gary's page that we put up. Or actually, you can go directly to the Albert Hoffman Foundation website. That's where we're linking most of the papers from. That's www.hoffman.org, and that's HOFMANN.org. And by the way, there is one paper that we put up on our website in a print-friendly version, and that's the one that Gary referred to from the Psychedelic Review. And I think it's probably the world's first paper on polydrugging, and provides a dosage table that I think also you're going to find quite useful and interesting. And also on the page we put up there for Gary, you'll find the link to the ayahuasca paper by Donald Topping. That's the man that Gary mentioned in his conversation earlier. And that paper, by the way, is on the MAPS website. So, again, www.maps.org. It's always a good place to go to see what's current in psychedelic research right now. And, of course, your first stop on the Internet for all questions relating to these issues is Arrowid, Arowid.org. And for legal issues, I'd go, first of all, I think, to Cognitive Liberty, all one word, cognitiveliberty.org. And all those sites, by the way, have a lot of crossover. I think you'll find them all interesting. And while you're out there surfing, by the way, why don't you surf on over to the Entheogen Review? That's Entheogenreview.org. The Entheogen Review, it bills itself as the Journal of Unauthorized Research on Visionary Plants and Drugs. I'll be talking more about that little jewel of a publication in the next podcast, but if you're not already a subscriber, you're missing out on some of the one of the probably best windows there is into the work that's now being done in this area, at least by the underground. And before I go, I want to be sure to thank Jacques and Cordell and Wells of Chateau Hayuk for the use of their music here in the Psychedelic Salon. And of course, a big thanks to Gary for putting up with my continuing attempts to get a decent recording of our conversations. I'll get it right one day, Gary, I promise. And just so I don't leave you with the impression that Gary Fisher thinks these powerful medicines are best left to the medical field to use. I'd like to read a few lines from Charlie Grobe's interview with Gary in his new book, Higher Wisdom. Charlie had, or maybe Roger Walsh did this, I'm not sure which one of them did the interview, but the question posed to Gary was, if psychedelics were sanctioned and people had access to settings where they could be used optimally, what might they accomplish? And here was Gary's answer to this question. I don't know how you could institutionalize psychedelics in the culture as it exists. I think that idea may be an oxymoron. The functional way is in a very informal manner, through one human to another, just as one might read a wonderful, insightful book and then want to share it with a friend. I think maybe that's the way the psychedelic experience will spread in an optimal fashion. I don't think I would start with trying to train psychiatrists or psychologists in the use of psychedelics. I can't see how putting them into a medical school or psychology department would work. I would just go around looking for people who are naturally kind. And who can disagree with that? What great advice, huh? Well, again, thanks to all of you for listening here today. I guess that's about it for now. This is Lorenzo, signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.